This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Hello, I'm Simon Mayo and this is our Film Reviews podcast. Mark Kermode was back this week. You can hear his views in just a moment. After that, there's another chance to hear my interview with Jamie Foxx and Jennifer Garner. Mark wasn't convinced by their new movie, The Kingdom. But then what does he know?
On DAB Digital Radio, Digital TV, downloads and online.
This is 5 Live.
You can watch all this and it's all being live streamed. That's the fun of it. If you go to the website, bbc.co.uk/5live, I imagine, because I haven't checked this, but I imagine all the instructions are blissfully straightforward. And you can see Mark wearing exactly the same as stuff that he wears always, which is a dark suit and a red tie. But he looks smart as opposed to the scruff bag opposite.
Yeah, you look terrible.
When did you last see your father? Control. What else have we got coming up? The Kingdom. All these movies coming up and to be reviewed. It's a busy old week. Let's do the box office top 10. Hey, we were refreshing it early.
It's a madly busy week.
We'll run off the end as we do normally. Yeah. War at number 10.
Jet Li thriller with Jet Li and Jason Statham, which I haven't seen, but I'm actually quite looking forward to because I have a thing. Jason Statham.
You shouldn't like him, but actually...
You do.
He's quite good.
It's impossible not to. And I had to do... I was researching a little piece for The Observer, and I had to look up on Google Jason Statham and oil wrestling. And believe me, that takes you into waters you don't want to go into.
You ridiculed me a couple of weeks back for Googling something just to check the lyrics for There's a Hole in My Bucket, which you said
Dear Elijah,
which clearly you were wrong
I'm
about.
I'm not going... I have fantastically discovered there's a site that's called something like alllyricsever.com. And I mean, it's not actually called that.
If you check it, you'll find that I was
right. But I found out the lyrics to White Man and Hammersmith Palais. And you know what? They're not as good as you think they are. They're not. When you hear them and you can't understand what he's saying, they sound brilliant. And then you read them and you go, ah. Oh.
Yeah, but the lyrics to Blue Suede Shoes are pretty poor. But in the context of the overall sound, it's pretty good. Number 9 is The Bourne Ultimatum, still in the top 10.
And still a cracking movie. And I imagine everybody's gone to see it now. I don't think it's as good as the second, but I think it's still so much better than so much Hollywood fodder. And the point that several people have made, and they're quite right, is it really has put the wind up the Bond franchise. When you look at why the Bond franchise has really got its act together, I think you do have to credit the Bourne movies with just raising the bar. And so now they know they can't go back to being the sort of fatuous entertainment they were before. They have to feel tougher. They have to feel, because everyone is now chasing it. And it's down to Paul Greengrass. He's just an extraordinarily talented director, and amazing to think he came out of Granada.
I quite like fatuous entertainment.
No, there was a place for it, but there's just not a place for it
now.
What is
the place for fatuous entertainment?
Because there's a certain point. I mean, the first Bond movie I ever saw was Live and Let Die, right? With Roger Moore, who is obviously the worst Bond. I mean, just by a million miles was the worst Bond. It's got Jane Seymour in it, and
music's good.
Yeah, great theme tune. It's got all that nonsense about the boat coming out and landing on this way. It's got the guy, the fat cop who spits and all that, and the guy wrestling with the crocodile. It's total rubbish. But the thing I remember most about Live and Let Die is there's a scene in it in which very early on, James Bond wakes up. Obviously he's in somebody's boudoir, and he wakes up, somebody goes beep, and he looks at his wrist, and he presses it, and digits say 605 or something. And the whole cinema went, wow, it's a digital watch.
Of all the unlikely boudoirs,
yes,
that Roger Moore ended up in, surely Grace Jones was the most bizarre.
Yes.
The most peculiar, the most fatuous. In fact, we should have a fatuous top five.
A fatuous top five.
Movies that you watch but are irredeemably fatuous. Anyway,
yes.
Mr. Woodcock at 8.
So disappointing. Billy Bob Thornton, comedy, which he's a bullying gym teacher and he's going to marry this woman who is the mother of somebody that he used to bully. And again, it's like so many Billy Bob Thornton comedies. You just think... I mean, I was never a huge fan of Bad Santa. I know everybody thinks it's some kind of masterpiece, but I just thought, more of the same. Disappointing. It's an interesting idea, but it doesn't work out very well.
The Brave One is at 7.
Jodie Foster movie. Sort of the most interesting thing that can be said about it. I mean, Jodie Foster, when she does really good work, does really good work. I like Panic Room, actually, the recent ones. But there has been a return of revenge thrillers recently. And I think, actually... It's funny how we've kind of managed to rehabilitate the revenge thriller. I still think nothing comes close to that fantastic Shane Meadows film, Dead Man's Shoes. Have you seen that?
I've forgotten.
With Paddy Considine?
No.
Great, great lo-fi thriller, which is basically Death Wish, but done in, you know, Northern Britain. And it's just great because it's a real guilty pleasure, but it's brilliantly done.
Michael Clayton is number six.
Which I like, a sort of, you know, intelligent, corporate, conspiracy, legally, like a little bit like The Insider, thrillery type thing. Intelligent, you know, plays to a higher audience. And has yet another very solid and good performance by George Clooney. I've said this several times. George Clooney is one of the good guys. And I know that he makes those Ocean's 11 and Ocean's 12 movies, and I really hate them, and they are terribly smug and terribly sort of self-congratulatory. But he is somebody who you do feel actually cares about the quality of the stuff that he makes. And when he's on screen, he doesn't mind, you know, making himself not entirely the most attractive man, although he's regularly voted the most attractive man in the whole world. And I just like him. I find it very hard to dislike anything he's done, although I find it very easy to dislike those Ocean's movies. And may I just, in passing, once again recommend to people Solaris, that was just so wrongly kicked around town and was a really intelligent remake of what was frankly a very boring original.
It was still only slightly less boring, though.
No, it wasn't. It was exactly half as boring, because it was exactly...
Yeah, half as boring as the original is still pretty boring.
No. The Tarkovsky original is 3 hours long, right? Yeah. The remake is 87 minutes.
Yeah.
Well, that's...
But half as boring as a really boring film makes it quite boring.
No, but I'm just being... fatuous, to use that word again. You can't say it's as boring as the original, because even if you think both films are boring, which incidentally I don't, the original is 3 hours of boring and this is 82 minutes.
Halloween's at 5.
And I haven't seen this. This is a Rob Zombie remake or update of Halloween. I have to go and see it, but I was away last week, as you know. And I mean, Rob Zombie to me is an idiot. I just don't have the respect for Rob Zombie that really makes
Why
me think
not?
Well, because, you know, Devil's Disciples, and he's just he's a friend of Quentin Tarantino's.
Oh, well, there you go.
And everybody thinks, wow, you know, hit new talent, and I think, you know, go away. I lived through this when I was young. I don't have to live through it again. Thank you.
So it's because he's a friend of Quentin's?
No, that's not why he's an idiot. I mean, being an idiot would make him a friend of Quentin's. Incidentally, it's quite good to see that Death Proof didn't do very well, did it?
Is it good then?
Yeah. Death Proof is rubbish. Weren't you here when I reviewed it?
Yes, I was.
I think you were the bloke sitting there.
I'm merely
it's
questioning
absolute rubbish
whether it is in fact a good thing.
No.
It has disappeared from the chart. The soundtrack's all right though.
Yeah, but that's, you know, it's such an easy thing, isn't it? Oh, Quentin Tarantino's soundtrack's right. And incidentally, in the case of Death Proof, the best thing on the soundtrack is that song by Willie DeVille, which of course was written for Cruising. And so it's not even from the soundtrack of Death Proof, it's from the soundtrack of Cruising. Can I suggest that we do the next, like, really quick, because we've got so much to get through.
Yeah, I just say the film and then
do one word.
The duration of everything
else.
Let's
do one word
for
the rest
of
them. Go on.
Number four, Superbad.
Film that reviews itself.
Three, I Now Pronounce You Chuck and Larry.
I Now Pronounce You Not Funny Enough.
Two is Atonement.
He Good, She Bad.
You know, you said one word, you failed.
I know,
but
you
time.
Know.
And at number one, Run, Fat Boy Run.
Well, you know, as we know, it's the best movie at last ever so far, says Sean Dingybat.
What's that one word that you're looking for?
Stop. Run, Fat Boy, Run, Stop. There we go.
Simon, can you ask Mark if he was at Poulton's Park near Southampton last weekend? I thought I saw him looking forlornly at the broken-down log flume. Tell him that if he was after an adrenaline rush, then the rabbit ride could have been an alternative.
Yeah, can I just say, the Poulton's Park log flume is an institution, right? And the sensible money is on doing it at the end. If you do it at the beginning, you spend the whole of the day wet, right? So you do it at the end, so you do everything else, and they've got this lovely new thing, you know, the Viper ride, or, you know, which is great, and we do all the stuff. And I really like, I go there a lot, right? And you get to the end of the day, and literally I've queued up for the log flume, which is my favourite because it's like old-fashioned and crunky, and just as we're about to get on, it breaks down. And literally people are escorted off the log flume from the thing. And I am, forlorn is not the word, heartbroken is the word. I've kind of paced my afternoon leading up to the log flume because I love that log flume.
Answer slightly longer than I was expecting.
You brought it up.
No Time Then for the PS. What's the best film set in a theme park? Almost certainly something that ends terribly, I would have thought.
There is a movie that's called Roller
Disaster at the Theme Park.
Disaster at the Theme Park. No, there is a movie called Roller Coaster, which as far as I remember is in Sensoround. And it's a thriller in the scene, but which has got Sensoround. And I have a great fondness for Sensoround just because it was in that period in which anybody thought that bowel rumbling bass sounds were really clever. Now, when every mini that goes by is going, it's not a big deal. But if you're my age, you know, that and Battle of Midway and an Earthquake. Remember Earthquake? You had to. There was a thing on the poster for Earthquake which said, "We accept no responsibility for any adverse effects you may have during this movie." Because nowadays, you'd have to sign that getting in a car.
Yes, the roller coaster sort of tagline thing,
yeah,
which wasn't really a tagline, but you are in a race against time and terror. You are pursuing a nameless, faceless man through America's greatest amusement parks, and for the first time, you are experiencing the most sensational rides of our time.
In Sensorland.
In Sensorland.
Can I just say, also, the worst movie ever set in theme park, Beverly Hills Cop 3.
I don't think I ever caught that
no,
one.
No, really, really poor. And after Eddie Murphy had made said some appalling things about John Landis, and then went back and worked with him, and it was just, you know, he said that John Landis had as much chance of working with him again as he did with an actor who had sadly died, and it was a really bad taste thing to have said. And then when it was brought up at the press conference, everyone got really cross. It's like, well, sorry, you know, hey,
what, sorry, what,
well, you know, you said it.
Oh, so therefore you look a loony. It's 3:23. We've given you the top 10. What else is new? Well, it's difficult to know where to start.
Well, look, let's start with Control, because let's start at home. You know, British movie, and it's always good to see a British movie that we can actually be excited about. So, Control, a sort of biopic of Ian Curtis and Joy Division, loosely based on Deborah Curtis's memoir, Touching from a Distance. Now, as everyone knows, we had not so long ago 24 Hour Party People, which I think was a wonderful film. Michael Winterbottom did a brilliant job of kind of chronicling the rise and fall of Factory Records. And there was so much going on in that film. And Joy Division play a little part in it. And then there's, you know, The Fall play a little part in it. And The Mondays play a little part in it. And it's really extraordinary. This is very specifically about Ian Curtis and Joy Division, Ian Curtis's relationship with his wife, Ian Curtis's relationship with his lover, Ian Curtis's relationship with epilepsy, Ian Curtis's very, very troubled relationship with fame. It's directed by Anton Corbijn. His name is spelled... Is it Corbin?
Corbin.
Corbin.
Anton,
okay.
Corbin, yeah.
It's spelled Corbijn. But
it's abroad.
It's from abroad,
it's from
it?
Abroad, and okay. That's why it's confusing.
Who, for people of my age, you'll remember as, you know, a rock photographer and then a video director, and had an extraordinarily good eye. And the film is shot in this kind of, you know, monochrome, which very much evokes the classic images of Joy Division, some of which were taken, you know, by other photographers, you know, obviously. But it's really got the look of it right. Now, the most interesting thing about it is, at a very early stage, there was a decision taken that Sam Riley, who's the guy playing Ian Curtis, was going to do his own vocals. And then it became apparent that actually the band might try and do their own music as well. And of course, if you know anything about Joy Division, you know Joy Division songs aren't that hard to play. Anyway, let's hear a clip. This is Craig Parkinson having a go at doing Tony Wilson. It's very, very hard to do Tony Wilson after Steve Coogan did such a brilliant job of doing Tony Wilson in that kind of slightly Alan Partridge-y way. And of course, you know, Tony Wilson came on the show a couple of years ago. He's now sadly not with us any longer. But this is a clip from Control, which I think demonstrates just how far away this is from 24 Hour Party People and a little bit of the music.
Seeing as how this is the first television programme which brought you the first appearances from everyone from the Beatles to the Buzzcocks, we like to think we bring you the most new and interesting sounds in the Northwest. They're called Joy Division and are a Manchester band except for the guitarist who comes from Salford. A very important distinction. This is called Transmission.
I mean, you can see the key thing with Joy Division songs, and actually I think this is why so many young bands started playing Joy Division songs, they're very easy to do. However, the crucial thing about it is Sam Riley, who is a great and emergent talent, who's in a band called 10,000 Things, which I've never heard of before, but apparently they're pretty riotous. I don't know where they're even still going. You're up with music. Do you know 10,000 Things?
No, 10,000 Maniacs.
No, not them.
Not the 10,000 Things, I'm afraid, no.
No, sorry, different band completely. 10,000 Maniacs, I've heard of. This is another band who aren't called that.
Okay, this isn't going anywhere.
No, fine, okay. So, Sam Riley...
You know that band you just mentioned?
Yeah, you'd never heard them either, fine. Sam Riley has been a rock performer. And, you know, he's played with bands, so he has some kind of rock presence anyway. But what he does is, he plays the character of Ian Curtis, and he does that really well. He clearly has got his acting chops. He actually had a small role, I think, in 24 Hour Party People. But when he gets on stage to perform the Joy Division songs, what you get is the voice of the person who you've been watching develop as a character. Now, I think this is really important. I think if you look at a film like La Vie en Rose, which a lot of people really like, the main problem with La Vie en Rose is there's no continuity between the voice of the character, as played by Marion Cotillard, and the singing voice, the Edith Piaf singing voice. Now, the argument is, well, nobody can sing like Piaf. maybe Marianne Cotillard can't sing it. Personally, I would rather hear somebody badly doing Edith Piaf, but doing it in their voice, than watch somebody lip-syncing to Piaf records. I mean, I think, for example, Gary Busey doing his own vocals in the Buddy Holly story is very, very important. It's a continuity of voice. And what you get with Control, which I keep wanting to call Closer, because you know, of course, you know, Joy Division,
the album, yeah.
Unknown Pleasures, Closer Still, which everybody says, oh, that's, obviously it's a sentence. Unknown Pleasures, Closer Still. But obviously not you. But
no, I realise that.
Thank you very much. Okay. So what you're getting is the continuity of his voice as this tortured character. Then you then hear that in the songs, and it actually makes sense in a way that a lot of rock biopics don't do. Point number one, I think that's very important. Point number two, it's a very unflashy movie, but it is visually stylish in a way which completely fits the material, not only because it reminds you of those extraordinary images that you used to see of Joy Division, you know, on that the bridge, the flyover in Manchester, which was on the front cover of the NME, and then, you know, later on became iconic. And I remember when I was at college, everyone had that posted on their wall. I have to say, I was never a big Joy Division fan. I was always a Concert Angels fan. I always thought the Concert Angels sounded like what Joy Division would sound like if they could play and sing. So, you know,
that's another thing you were wrong about.
No, I was right about it.
You weren't.
No, I was. If you put the first three Concert Angels albums back to back with the Joy Division album,
what would you think would happen if we had a Concert Angels versus Joy Division text vote?
Well, I'm telling you now that the Waiting for a Miracle, Sleep No More, and Fiction, between them, are a better trilogy of albums than Unknown Pleasures, Closer, and Still. I'm sorry, they just are. Go ahead, you put it to the country if you want to, but it's you may not have the same landslide as you have with Lilac Wine and Bonio, but the Concert Angels were a it doesn't matter in relation to the film. I'm just telling you, as a matter of fact, the Concert Angels were a better band.
It's text only till a quarter two, but it would just be interesting to know just how wrong you are on a scale of wrongness with, you know, Elvis Is Still Alive at one end with Neil Young at the other. Okay, things I've been wrong about. Let's just see where Concert Angels versus Joy Division comes in.
Yeah, sorry, Concert Angels all the way. Anyway, to finish this, because there are other good things about the movie as well. Samantha Morton, who plays Ian Curtis's long-suffering, it has to be said, spouse, I think does a great job with a frankly difficult role and a somewhat underwritten role, ironically, of course, since it's based on Deborah Curtis's original memoirs. But she does bring real heart and soul to that role, and makes her so much more than just the cipher, just the wife that gets left at home. And in the end, it may be true that you don't get right inside the mind of the character, it may be that Ian Curtis was fairly impenetrable, and there are certainly things about his character that in the end remain completely impenetrable, but its heart is solidly in the right place, its music is spot on, its visual, you know, facility is absolutely as it should be. It features a couple of really, really outstanding performances. As a debut feature, it's hard to fault. And although I have to say, personally, I think 24 Hour Party People is a more important film, having seen Control first in Cannes and then back here now, I think it's a really fine piece of work. And I would rather, and I know other people have said this because this is what everyone was saying in Cannes, I'd rather listen to those guys playing the Joy Division songs than listen to Joy Division playing them.
But you're not going to buy the soundtrack, though. You're going to want to have the Joy Division records, aren't you?
No, I've got the Joy Division records.
Yeah, and if you had to choose...
And I've often played the next the Concert Angels records and said, you know what, these Concert Angels albums are better.
Does the big wheel in the third man, says this text, qualify for
an inclusion
in the best theme park question? If so,
well,
there's your winner.
It's a fairground climax, though. It's not a fairground movie, is it? The whole movie isn't set in the fairground.
Phil in Crap. Well, that's why he's asking, I think. Phil on this.
Well, I'm giving you an answer. No.
Well, you're wrong. Roller Coaster featured the Mighty Sparks performing Beat the Clock under Loop the Loop. Is that right? In which case, it's worth just revisiting for a moment.
I had forgotten that. I had absolutely forgotten that. But Beat the Clock's great, isn't it? And how marvellous that Sparks were a band in which they had a keyboard player dressed as Hitler and nobody said, you know what, you really can't do that.
And better than the Concert Angels, Sparks.
The Sparks?
Yes.
Kimona My House is a good album.
Put it in the mix. So reviews to come. Give us two that you're definitely going to do in the next section.
We're definitely going to do When Did You Last See Your Father? And we're definitely going to do The Heartbreak Kid.
And on the Joy Division Concert Angels thing, most people are saying Concert Who. And of course, in this argument, out of Joy Division, when they lost their lead singer, they got New Order. And Concert Angels, when they lost their lead singer, it became Soup. And I think that's the end of that argument. So what else is new, Mark?
I'm just not even going to go there with
You haven't lost again, have you?
No, I haven't. It just demonstrates
not that wrong again.
Swimming against the tide, popular misconception.
So Soup better than New Order?
The Concert Angels made 9 or 10 albums, you know, and I stand by five or six
argued.
Of them. No, I'm sorry. Okay, let's just. All I would say to you is go back and listen to Waiting for a Miracle. Listen to Waiting for a Miracle and listen to Unknown Pleasures, and you tell me which one of those albums is more groundbreaking. Which one of those albums is, you know, further for Sheffield versus Manchester? They had the edge.
Also out this week in the cinemas this week.
The Heartbreak Kid, which is nominally a remake of the 1972. Let me just pass you your coffee.
I was going to wander.
I know
over.
You were going
help
to
myself.
Elaine May movie, which of course was originally scripted by Neil Simon and shot, I think, by Owen Roisman, who was, of course, one of the great cinematographers of all time, who shot The French Connection and, of course, the movie which we shall not name. So, remade now by the Farrellys, for whom I have a soft spot. There is more to the Farrellys than their sort of dumb and dumber reputation. You know, they're not as dumb as they make out. They're actually sort of quite intelligent people. So the story in the remake is that Ben Stiller, his love life is stalled. He's a middle-aged man. He decides he needs to find somebody. Then he finds the right woman. He marries her in a hurry. Then they go on a honeymoon. And when they're on honeymoon, it turns out that the woman that he thought was absolutely wonderful is less wonderful than he thought at the point that he married her. Here's a clip.
Stop worrying about money. This is our honeymoon. You don't remember this for the next 40 to 50 years.
Gotta remember, we're a two-income family now.
Honey, I'm a volunteer.
You told me you're an environmental researcher.
Yeah, I am.
You get stung by a jellyfish, that makes you an environmental researcher?
You know what, Eddie? I love my job, and I don't have to defend it to you.
Job? No. I don't think you're allowed to call it a job.
Oh, really? And what am I supposed to call it?
A hobby?
A hobby?
A hobby. You get paid for a job.
Says who?
Says the dictionary. That's
well,
a job.
Who reads the dictionary? Not everybody.
Yeah, apparently not. A job is a word. You get there is a
you
definition
married
for
me
it.
For my money.
What? No, wait a minute. Don't turn this around.
What's next? You're going to steal my purse like my last boyfriend did?
So the problem that you have, basically, is that it's like two movies jammed together. On the one hand, you have the ghost of the Neil Simon thing, which is basically a character comedy, the Elaine May movie. It's a character comedy. It's a comedy about, you know, of awkwardness and difficulty and embarrassment. On the other hand, you have the Farrellys, who do like going down market. They do like doing, you know, filthy, lewd jokes in a kind of really Dumbo way. And occasionally they get away with it. Now, I think one of the most interesting things about the Farrellys is that although they've been accused in the past of being really dumb, they have done stuff which is more radical than it seems to be. I mean, I liked something about Mary, for example, but one of the most interesting things about them is that they were accused at one point of being unfair to disabled people and making jokes at the expense of disabled people. And they took this criticism very, very seriously because they absolutely didn't. They thought they were doing completely the opposite. And one of the things they ended up doing was casting people in their movies who had disabilities that were not apparent in any way. And it was very interesting. I mean, it was a very interesting way of doing something without showing off about it, but being smarter than people thought you were. And I've interviewed both of them, and they're smart people. And I can see why they'd be attracted to a project like this. But the problem is, it just doesn't work. It just doesn't pull itself together in a way that marries the, on the one hand, the sort of urbane, sophisticated comedy, on the other hand, the low-end, low-rent comedy. One of the interesting things about it is that if you go to the BBFC website, which I would advise anybody to do, there is the most brilliant explanation of why the film has been given a 15 certificate. And it says things like, for example, the guidelines on language state that the strongest term, the word which must not be said, will only be acceptable where justified by context. In the context of this film, that is, by a woman in pain to a man with obvious comic intent, it was felt that the word could be passed at that level. It then goes on to explain that the film contains strong sex, including sadomasochism and bestiality, but all presented in a comic way that doesn't in any way sort of glorify them. And the BBFC website originally said that the film wasn't cut. It was digitally altered to get a 15 certificate. And digitally altered it to get a 15 certificate.
Right. In what way would they...
I'm not going to go into
should
it.
Should we just...
No, so I'm no, but...
We'll just let that run.
So what you have on the one hand is you have the kind of the R-rated end. It's kind of getting back into the gross-out stuff that, you know, they want to be. On the other hand, you have the sophisticated urban comedy. In the middle of it all, you have Ben Stiller is not really holding all the things together. And you have a script which is fairly lame because it feels like it's pulling in two different directions. And you have Stiller doing that performance that kind of reminds me of Adam Sandler, which is that rule about he's not funny, he's creepy. I mean, I think Stiller can be funny, but in this particular case, he's just creepy. And it's okay to be just creepy if you're not asking the audience to feel any sympathy towards you. Because the thing is, I hate him. I don't like his character in the film, so therefore it's very hard to feel any sympathy when his character then has a hard time with the woman that he married, who becomes the butt of the joke. So it's 2 hours long. It's not funny enough. It's not as funny as the original. It's not up with the best work of its creators. And all in all, it's a bit of a stiff.
Comes at Angels lost the vote, quarter two, so we stopped the count. clearly outnumbered by people who realise that if there's, you know, if you had to choose, it's going to be Joy Division all the way. Can you mention one band that was influenced by the Comsat Angels?
Border Incident.
Border Incident, that's right. And, of course, Soup, with a long string of successes.
This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Jamie Foxx on the programme yesterday talking about the movie The Kingdom.
Have you seen The Kingdom?
I haven't seen The Kingdom.
Okay.
I know it's a central premise. I know it's that there's a suicide bomb right at the beginning, very horrible one, kills 100 people, 200 people injured. This is in Saudi, and the FBI go in and try and sort it out.
And they get very little cooperation. Here's a clip.
This is too pretty of a plan to be hatched in just one day. He had to come here a couple of times.
This man is a Saudi. See, if foreigners were here, someone would say something.
So maybe Abu Hamza.
Could be.
Yeah, we should ask around. Get out of here, some people.
They won't tell you anything.
Why not?
He's like Robin Hood to you. People feel sympathy to him.
Well, we know two things. We know he was Saudi. We know he was here. That's two big answers in 2 minutes. Imagine if we had a couple of days. General Malik got his heart in the right place, but he is clearly not an investigator. But listen, let me help you.
It's a detonator. Where
yeah,
you
it's
broken?
A gift from us to you. We found it at the bomb site. Run with that.
And for a lot of the movie, that's what you get. You get talking and, you know, serious. And, yeah, it's really about the political situation. Very good. And then it goes mad. And then it goes into a big chase sequence. Everyone's running around. And there's guns. And there's action. And there's thing. And it's, you know, and it goes into a high-octane, edge-of-your-seat thriller. Now, on the subject of movies which look like two movies jammed together, this is a perfect example. It just doesn't know which of the two things it wants to be, whether it wants to be a serious movie or whether it wants to be an action thriller. And it ends up really having a solid action sequence in it. I mean, there is a really good action sequence, although it's completely preposterous. I mean, completely preposterous.
This is physically impossible?
Because it's a really silly action sequence. I mean, there's one whole thing that's going on in it, which is to do with, you know, that you're almost going to have a video style execution. Meanwhile, outside there's a running gun battle and all these different paths cross. And it's like a James Bond style action sequence. It's very visceral, very edge of your seats, but that's what it is.
Jamie Foxx said yesterday there's a sequence with a marble that when you see it, you'll go, ah.
Yeah.
And I thought, obviously, I haven't seen it, so I don't know.
That's one of those kind of the revelation moments.
Okay. I'm not going to spoil it.
What I'm going to say is this: there's a great tradition in cinema in which a very small detail, it's like, for example, you've seen The Taking of Pelham 1, 2, 3.
Yes.
And he shuts the door and he sneezes. Gesundheit.
Sneeze. Yeah, absolutely.
Fine.
It's one of those.
He doesn't cough, because you don't say Gesundheit when people cough. You say, would you mind putting your hand over your mouth? You're spreading germs on the tube.
If you've got a flu, you've got a bit of both.
Exactly. So, but the problem with it is that it the seriousness doesn't work at all. It really doesn't work. It doesn't have any serious stuff to talk about, really. The action sequence is a good action sequence, but in that case, don't try and case it in the serious. And then at the end of the action sequence, it all tries to tie itself back to a serious message, which is that in the end, aren't we all a bit... And it all felt a little bit, and it's the third time for this show, fatuous. It's not a bad movie, and like I said, the action sequence is... real kind of, you know, high octane pulsing stuff, but it is not, as Bill McCuddy of the Fox News Channel,
oh Bill,
who he says the best film of the year so far, by far.
There must be a whole battery of these people.
Who are these people?
If you need a good quote, there must be someone somewhere on some little station somewhere in middle America which will come up with a quote that you need.
But it's just, you know, he's on the Fox News Channel, right? It's a big channel. Who is he? He's not a film critic, is he? It's like every middle of the road hodgepodge movie that doesn't work and has got loads of, with the best will in the world, this is not the best movie of the year so far, by far, so far. It just isn't.
Is the ultimate message of the film, you know what, underneath it all, we're all the same, we're all Arab and American together facing the bad guy.
You know what it is? The message of the movie is, let's get him. But hey, you know what?
Gently.
No, not generally. Hey, you know what? We're all kind of as bad as each other. But let's get... that's what I mean. It's completely jumbled and garbled, and it doesn't really make any sense. But there is a ripping action sequence in the middle of it. It seems very odd when you've got this sort of somber pontificating going on around the edges. So it's a misshapen beast. What's that that fantastic phrase that a camel is a horse designed by a committee?
Yeah.
Well, this is a camel of a movie.
Very good.
Thank you.
Now, we haven't got a clip for the Colin Firth movie, but...
We have.
I've been told that we haven't.
Oh, we haven't. Okay, fine. Well, the Colin Firth movie, and when did you last see your father in that case?
Unless you did something with it on the way in, did you?
No, no, we did have one, but I don't know where it's gone. But it's okay. I can describe. It's perfectly fine. We don't need to.
A man's gone looking for
it. No, don't worry, because I'd like actually also to play a clip from the Michael Moore film in a minute. So,
okay.
When did you last see your father? Adaptation of Blake Morrison's novel, memoir about his father, and it's somebody looking back on their life and looking back on their relationship, their troubled relationship with their father, and, you know, melancholically remembering and trying to sift through. And of course, the central question, you know, because there's a very famous painting, and when did you last see your father, which is all that. Title is tied up with a lot of complicated things because, of course, that question, as the title of the painting, is all to do with, you know, with guilt. It's not to do with, it's not a concerned question. It's an interrogating question. So that's going on. It's basically him trying to remember the last time his father was his father before all this stuff happened. Two central performances by Colin Firth and Jim Broadbent, both of whom are very, very fine performers. I have a particularly soft spot for Colin Firth, who I think is sometimes underrated as an actor. I mean, people think of him as, you know, the Darcy character and the, you know, the funny and the witty, you know, urbane, brittle British comedy and Bridget Jones. I think he has much more depth than that. I really liked him in Trauma, which the Mark Evans movie, which very few people saw. I thought he gave a performance of great conviction in that film, which he played somebody who was psychotic and was falling apart, and he did it really, really well. So on the positive side, it is a very British film. It's a very honest film. I think it feels heartfelt in that it feels very much like a personal memoir, which is what it is. And you believe in the grief and the difficulty, and you believe in the way in which memory is depicted. All those things ring true. I have to confess, my reservations are, and I know this sounds like an easy thing to say, it feels small enough to be televisual. And that's a problem
for
me.
Not like The Queen.
No, yes, not unlike The Queen. I mean, actually, funnily enough, I feel like if I'd seen it on a small screen, most of the reservations I had about it probably wouldn't happen. It does feel almost too small for its own good. It's produced by Steve Woolley, who directed Stoned, which I thought was a much more cinematic movie. Stoned, of course, died on its feet, which is a real shame, although it was very underrated, but it was clearly a piece of cinema. I don't know that this is a piece of cinema. There are moments in it in which it sort of lapses back into... You know, it's too soft and too gentle to really grab the audience. But to its credit, it never plays for the... You don't feel like it's playing for the big audience. I mean, actually, I think the best thing that you can say about it in those terms is it doesn't feel like it minds how big its audience is. It feels like it wants to be the movie that it is, and it wants to be honourable to its source, and it wants to be honourable to its characters. And in the end of the day, you think, well, that's probably a higher aspiration than saying, you know what? It hasn't got a massive audience. Let's fix it.
There's a very moving section at the end. In fact, when Jim Broadbent came on a couple of weeks ago,
yeah.
But it's the scene where after he's died and Colin Firth finally, and clearly that's not giving anything away.
No, yes, I know, of course.
But Colin Firth finally breaks down when he's standing outside the house, which is fantastic.
Do you see what I mean about Colin Firth? He is an actor with real depth, and I think it's a shame that sometimes people don't quite give him the credit for that because he's handsome and because he's charismatic. But he has got a lot of other things going on in there. So, you know, with reservation, as I said again, it is a British film. It feels British, and I like that about it. So there is much to like. I can't unequivocally embrace it, but there is much to admire, and the things that are wrong with it, I kind of admire for being wrong with it as well. Can we very briefly...
I just say hello to Dave and hello to Jason, by the way, who are listening on podcast? Thanks for listening again, guys. We've got a new Michael Moore movie out.
No, we haven't. It's a film about Michael Moore, so that's the thing.
It's still a Michael Moore movie.
Manufacturing Descent. I think it's pretty clear where I stand on Michael Moore. So Manufacturing Descent is a documentary about how Michael Moore basically twists the truth and isn't the great guy that he's cracked up to be, and how his documentaries, you know, play fast and loose with facts, and how he manufactures stuff and blah, 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 which is all stuff I kind of know about. It's not made by rabid right-wingers, because there is a great big right-wing industry making, you know, websites about how evil Michael Moore is. He's not any of those things. It's made by a bunch of Canadians who are very liberal and very open-minded, who try and make a documentary about Michael Moore and find out that he's actually very difficult to deal with. And in the course of it, they go back and go over a lot of stories from all the movies that he's made before and find, as is no surprise to anybody, that Michael Moore tends to play fast and loose with the facts. And the most interesting stories, I was going to play you a clip, but I think we probably haven't got time. But I can.
No, yeah. Well, how many more things do you want to fit in before?
I can do that. Okay, fine. This is a central clip. Roger and Me, right? Central premise of Roger and Me. He spent the whole time attempting to interview the head of General Motors. He never got to meet him, yeah? Apparently he did.
We went to the Waldorf Astoria in New York. It wasn't a shareholders meeting. It was just for the people who owned the most shares of General Motors, the corporate investors, Wall Street, and they wanted to show off their new cars and say how great they were and everything. Michael and I got in and got access to Roger Smith. You know, he sat there and answered questions for about 10 or 15 minutes. And it was some great footage because it was Smith answering questions one-on-one from Michael. Michael called me in the middle of the night and just said, basically, can you just say that this doesn't exist? And I said, it exists. There's a transcript of it. I'm not going to fall on my sword for you. I said to him, Michael, you talked to him twice already. How can you do a movie on something you've done already? He said, well, I can make it look like anything I want. It'll just go on a cutting room floor.
And the other key charges against Moore are there's a soldier who's featured in Fahrenheit 9/11 who's really objected to footage of him being used because he was actually very, very pro the war. There's a very interesting discussion about that scene in Bowling for Columbine in which he goes into the bank and comes out with a gun, in which it's revealed that the whole thing was set up. The vault isn't there. The guns are, you know, a long way away. You can't go into the bank and walk out with a gun. That's all kind of set up. There is also some, I think, very valid criticism of the last moment of Bowling for Columbine in which he goes and does that ludicrous thing about beating up Charlton Heston, not beating him up, but verbally attacking Charlton Heston in his house. Which is, as one commentator says, it's just mean. It's just mean. Also, incidentally, I have a kind of question about that sequence, which is, answer me this. If there's only one camera there, who's shooting the shot of Michael Moore showing Charlton Heston the picture? That's for future reference. It's not a brilliant piece of work.
Noddy cutaway, is it?
Yeah, but it's not meant to be. I mean, it looks like that to me, and maybe there's an explanation, but every time I see it, I think, I'm sorry, who's shooting the shot of Michael Moore holding the thing up? As I said, it's not a masterpiece, but if, like me, you are liberal, but on the other hand, don't trust Michael Moore any more than you trust George Bush, it's playing to the choir, and there is a lot of stuff in it that I really liked seeing, and it did seem to suggest that, as I'd always thought, much of what he says is fabricated baloney, and he's more interested in self-publicity than he can get to the truth.
So you're right about some things, that's what you're saying. Movie of the week?
Well, I think Control by quite, it's the best movie of the year so far by far. I'm not saying that, but I really like it.
On DAB Digital Radio, Digital TV, downloads and online.
This is 5Live.
I'm delighted to say we can speak to Jamie Foxx and Jennifer Garner. They have a new movie out this week. It's called The Kingdom. They join me. Good afternoon, Jamie. Good afternoon, Jennifer.
Hey.
Good afternoon.
Hey.
What's happening?
Well, you're happening.
All right.
And you're on.
Yes, we are.
Thanks for being patient. Thanks for talking to us. Just give us a brief outline between you. Maybe you could alternate between you here, Jamie and Jennifer. Just give us a brief outline as to where we are with The Kingdom.
Jennifer starts it out.
Here we go. Okay, it's about four FBI agents who go to Saudi Arabia. Ready to go.
And they're tracking a killer over there, and they meet another Saudi Arabian police officer who...
who you think is going to be the bad guy, but you get to know him. You see him at home with his family, and it turns out...
he's a good guy, and he breaks your heart at the end of the film, and you cry.
We could have done that as a parlor game, where you say it, you take it in turns to say a word.
There it is.
Yes.
That's probably not the best description I've heard of the movie, but it'll be fine because it comes from you two guys. So, Jamie, tell us a bit about Ronald Fleury and the kind of character that he is, this special agent that you play.
Ronald Fleury is a FBI agent when his friend, who's also an FBI agent, friend of all of ours, he gets killed in this bomb blast over in Riyadh. It becomes personal for him, so he takes himself, Jennifer's character, Chris Cooper, and we go over to Saudi Arabia to...
Investigate the crime.
You've got this off to a tee now, haven't you?
Yeah, we could do this all day.
Okay, now, your agent, Jennifer, tell us about her, because she sounds something special.
Janet Mays is a little something special. Thanks for noticing. She
it was a
pleasure. She is an FBI agent who is doing pretty well. She's pretty far up in the ranks for somebody as young as herself, and the man that is killed in Saudi Arabia is her best friend, Fran Manners. And so, as she goes with her colleagues over to investigate the crime, she's struggling with her own mix of emotions, anger and sadness.
Right at the heart, Jamie, of this film is a terrifying terrorist attack in Saudi. Just explain the circumstances of that, which start this ball rolling.
Well, what happens is that once that bomb blast happens and we lose a friend, as FBI agents, we're supposed to be non-emotional, but our emotions get to us, and so we have to pull some tricks. We have to trick the American side, because the American side is really in bed with Saudi and the oil and everything like that. So to not wreck their money, their business, we tricked them to get over and just find out what happened. We want to really find out what happens to our friend. And in doing that, in meeting Ashraf's character, who, like we said at the beginning, who you know, we don't know if he's on our side or against us, but come to find out that he wants to discover who's been committing these murders also. And so now you have an action film. It's like CSI set inside this sort of a political arena.
So are you both motivated by revenge?
I think initially, that's one of the themes that the movie really struggles with, is that if you're punched, if somebody punches somebody you love, your initial reaction, like it or not, is going to be to punch back. And this movie is saying that is not working anymore, that we've got ourselves trapped in a cycle of violence and we have to figure another way out.
Now, just a word from both of you on working with Saudi Colonel Al-Ghazi. This is Ashraf's character that you were talking about. Jamie, this is right at the heart of the movie, isn't it? This relationship between you.
Yes, it is. And it's, like I said, it's something that's different. Everyone who you know, when you first see the promos for this movie, you think, oh my goodness, this is going to be another political Middle Eastern movie. And it's not. And that's what's golden about it. The relationships that we have is just humans in this, because we're very small in it. Him on the Saudi side, when he says that, you know, he's been trying to figure out things for the longest but hadn't had any help. So we help him. So you really see the human side of all of these characters.
Well, what's amazing is that you get to see everybody at home with their families. Everyone is seen as a full human being. There are no judgments made on the characters for you, no kind of good or evil. It's you see everyone as a full human.
So does it become a sort of a buddy movie then?
Yes, it is. A buddy movie between all of us. We all become sort of like family. And I don't want to give the movie away, but there's one scene dealing with a marble, and when that happens, you see all of us sort of come together like, yo, this is what it's really all about. And when you see that marble, and you see Jennifer Garner's character's face, when she sees that marble, that's when everybody becomes family at that time.
What sort of a marble is it? What sort of marble are we talking about?
It's a blue marble. I think it's called a stink eye that kids flick to each other in the playground.
Right. And why is this so special, Jennifer?
You have to see that movie, because when you see that... Listen,
I'm talking to you at the moment. I want to know
that's what I'm saying. Well, I'm going to tell you. When you see that marble, there is a collective gasp in the theater, and we premiered this movie for everybody. When they see that marble, everybody goes, oh my goodness. And at that moment, that's when we become family.
Yeah, you're right, Jamie Foxx.
There you go.
Mm. You're right, Jamie Foxx. You're right, Jennifer Garner. How different are Saudi police ways to FBI ways?
Very. In many, many ways, they're different. As a woman, I would say, you know, a woman would never even be considered for the Saudi police force. She would be looked right through. She would is a non-entity. So that's from my point of view.
Yeah, well, and it was difficult in the fact of here we are coming from the Western side with our ways, and our ways are gung-ho. Mm-hmm. FBI is like, yo, we're going to get things done, period. We don't care about Democrat, Republican. We're going to get it. Everybody knows in the States that when the feds come knocking on that door, it's jail time. So to go over to the Saudi Arabian side, there are different things that you have to take into account. Their culture, the way they go about solving crimes, and sometimes because of the culture of what was going on, it made it tough for us as FBI agents to conduct the
investigation.
There you go.
Very good. You're finishing off each other's sentences.
Yeah.
You're sound like an item now. This text from Brian in Manchester. Simon, it's a great film. I saw it last night with a great twist at the end. Would there have been a time, maybe a couple of years ago, Jamie and Jennifer, that this would have been a big jingoistic all-American film? You would have gone over there and you'd have kicked some Arab doors in, and that's really what it would have been about?
Possibly, but the filmmakers were so careful to make sure that that was not the case with this film. We took great pains to show as much respect as we could to the Saudi Arabian culture, to the Saudi Arabian characters, and to make sure, I mean, Jamie has my favorite line in the movie, which is, look, we're Americans, we don't do everything perfectly, we're not claiming to, but this is something we do well.
Mm-hmm. Great.
It just sounded like a door opening and someone doubtless saying, come on, guys, you've got to go and talk to someone else. But just while we still have you for a couple of moments.
What?
We're not going anywhere. We're with you the rest of the afternoon. Yeah.
That's all right.
Yeah.
Okay, good. So You're with us for the duration, aren't you?
Yeah, there you go.
All day, tomorrow.
So is the message of the movie, apart from all the twists and stuff which we can't go into, and the significance of the marble, which we can't go into either, is that basically that Americans and Arabs are all on the same side and fighting the same people?
Oh, no, it's not that. I don't think it's that type of message. It's not as political. You haven't seen the movie, right?
No, correct.
Okay, well, if you get a chance to see it, you're going to go on an action ride. You're going to go on something that you didn't expect. Am I right?
Definitely. And not only that, I think the ultimate message of the movie is a reminder to look past whatever stereotypes have been created by the media, by Hollywood, by just the way we paint the world in definite color, instead of seeing that actual people all have the same goals. We want our kids to grow up safe and protected and have a chance to thrive and be happy. And that is what this movie is about, is that we are all the same.
Mm-hmm. Michael Mann is one of the producers, Jamie and Jennifer. What kind of training does he like you to do for this?
Pete actually had a lot to do with our training. And we, you know, the FBI was incredibly generous with their time. They spent a lot of time with us, teaching us about forensics, and we actually got to join a class of people from evidence response teams around the country, and they were learning about bombs and how to tell what kind of bomb went off and investigate that.
Yeah. And Jamie, presumably this is kind of training that you were quite used to. Didn't you get the script for this while doing Miami Vice?
Yeah, because I think they thought the Miami Vice wasn't going that well, so they said, here, try this script.
Well, they were wrong.
No, I'm just kidding. Actually, yeah, we did a lot of training with guns in Miami Vice. So with that being said, we went on, and it was sort of like second nature for the guns. And then some of the stunts that you'll see in the movie, the last 30 minutes of this movie is brilliant, because it's not just like action scenes that come out of nowhere. They're necessary. Mm-hmm. We have to pull out guns.
And that's where the marble comes out, is it?
There it is.
There, that's the marble.
What do we see you in next, Jennifer?
Well, in a couple of weeks, I start performances in New York City with Kevin Kline and Cyrano. And I know, it makes
Why
me
are
so...
Because
I'm so nervous, I could
Don't
die.
Be nervous.
I can't even think about
it. Are you
it.
Kidding me?
Because it's coming. I mean, it is definitely coming. David Laveau is directing that. He's a Brit. And then I have a little movie called Juno coming out this winter.
Jamie, what next for you?
We're going to do the Soloist with one of your own, Joe Wright, who also directed Atonement and was the youngest director to open up the Venice Film Festival. He also directed Pride and Prejudice. So we're doing Soloist with Robert Downey Jr.
Beautiful. I can't wait to see you in this one.
Jamie and Jennifer, appreciate you talking to us. Thanks very much.
Thank you
very much.
Jamie Foxx, Jennifer Garner, starring in The Kingdom.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.